In the dark, Anne could do nothing but consider her life and all she had worked so hard to accomplish. For centuries, she had led the Sisters of the Light in their effort to see the Creator's light triumph in the world, and see the Keeper of the Underworld kept where he belonged, in his own realm, the world of the dead. For centuries, she had waited in dread of the time that prophecy said was now upon them. For 500 years, she had waited for the birth of the one who had the chance to succeed in leading them in the struggle to see the Creator's gift, magic, survive against those who would cast that light out of the world. For 500 years, she had worked to ensure that he would have a chance to do what he must if he was to have a chance to stop the forces that would extinguish magic. Prophecy said that only Richard had the chance to preserve their cause, to keep the enemy from succeeding in casting a gray pall over mankind, the only one with a chance to prevent the gift from dying out. Prophecy did not say that he would prevail. Prophecy said only that Richard was the only one to have a chance to bring them victory. Without Richard, all hope was lost. That much was sure. For this reason, Anne had been devoted to him long before he was born, before he rose up to become their leader. Kaelin saw all of Anne's efforts as meddling, as tinkering with the lives of others. Kaelin believed that Anne's efforts were, in fact, the cause of the very thing she feared most. Anne hated that she sometimes thought that maybe Kaelin was right. Maybe it was meant to be that Richard would be born and by his free will alone would choose to do those things that would lead them to victory in their battle to keep the gift among men. Zed certainly believed that it was only by Richard's mind, by his free will, by his conscious intent, that he could lead them. Maybe it was true, and Anne, in trying to direct those things that could not be and should not be directed, had brought them all to the brink of ruin. The footsteps were coming closer. Maybe it was time to eat, and they were bringing dinner. She wasn't hungry. When they brought her food, they put it on the end of a long pole and then threaded that pole through the little opening in the outer door, all the way across the outer shielded room, through the opening in the second inner door, and finally into Anne. Nathan would risk no chance for escape by having her guards have to open her cell door merely to give her food. They passed in a variety of breads, meats, and vegetables, along with water skins. Although the food was good, she found no satisfaction in it. Even the finest fare could never be satisfying, eaten in a dungeon. At times, as prelate, she had felt as if she were a prisoner of her post. She had rarely gone to the dining hall where Sisters of the Light had eaten, especially in the later years. It put everyone on edge having the prelate among them at dinner. Besides, done too often, it took the edge off their anxiety, their discomposure around authority. Anne believed that a certain distance, a certain worried respect, was necessary in order to maintain discipline. In a place that had been spelled so that time slowed for those living there, it was important to maintain discipline. Anne appeared to be in her 70s, but with her aging process slowed dramatically while living under the spell that had covered the Palace of the Prophets, she had lived close to 1,000 years. Of course, a lot of good her discipline had done her. Under her watch as prelate, the Sisters of the Dark had infested her flock. There were hundreds of sisters, and there was no telling just how many of them had taken dark oaths to the Keeper. The lure of his promises were obviously effective. Such promises were an illusion, but try to tell that to one so pledged. Immortality was seductive to women who watched everyone they knew outside the palace grow old and die while they remained young. Sisters who had children saw those children sent out of the palace to be raised where they could have a normal life, saw those children grow old and die, saw their grandchildren grow old and die. To a woman who saw such things, saw the constant withering and death of those she knew while she herself all the time seemed to remain young, attractive and desirable, the offer of immortality grew increasingly tempting when her own petals began to wilt. Growing old was a final stage, the end of a life. Growing old in the Palace of the Prophets was a very long ordeal. Anne had been old for centuries. Being young for a very long time was a wonderful experience, but being old for a very long time was not. At least it was not for some. For Anne, it was life itself that was wonderful, not so much her age and all that she had learned. But not everyone felt that way. Now that the palace had been destroyed, they would all age at the same rate as everyone else. What had only a short time ago been a future of maybe another 100 years of life for Anne was suddenly perhaps no more than the blink of a decade, certainly not much more. But she doubted she would live all that long in such a dank hole away from light and life. Somehow it didn't seem as if she and Nathan were close to 1,000 years old. She didn't know what it felt like to age at the normal rate outside the spell, but she believed she felt little different than those outside the palace felt as they aged. She believed that the spell that slowed their aging also altered their perception of time, to a degree, anyway. The footsteps were getting closer. Anne wasn't looking forward to another meal in this place. She was beginning to wish they would let her starve and get it over with. Let her die. What good had her life been? When she really thought about it, what good had she really accomplished? The Creator knew how she tried to guide Richard in what needed to be done, but in the end it seemed that it was Richard's choice to act as he did, in most cases against what she thought needed to be done. That turned out to be correct. Had she not tried to guide events, bring him to the Palace of the Prophets in the old world, maybe nothing would have changed. And that would have been the way he was to save them all. By not having to act and letting Jigang and the Imperial Order eventually wither and die in the old world, unable to spread their virulent beliefs beyond. Maybe she'd brought it all to ruin with her efforts alone. She heard the door at the end of the passageway to her cell scrape open. She decided that she wouldn't eat. She wouldn't eat again until Nathan came to speak with her, as she had requested. Sometimes with the food they sent in wine. Nathan sent it in to vex her, she was sure of that. From his confinement in the Palace of the Prophets, Nathan had sometimes requested wine. Anne always saw the report when such a request was made. She declined every such request. Wizards were dangerous enough. Prophets, who were wizards with the talent of prophecy, were potentially vastly more dangerous, and drunken prophets were the most dangerous of all. Prophecy given out willy-nilly was an invitation to calamity. Even simple prophecy escaping the confines of the stone walls of the Palace of the Prophets had started wars. Nathan had sometimes requested the company of women. Anne hated those requests the most, because she sometimes granted them. She felt she had to. Nathan had little of life, confined as he was to his apartments. His only real crime being the nature of his birth, his abilities. The palace could easily afford the price of a woman to sometimes visit him. He made a mockery of that often enough, giving out prophecy that sent the woman fleeing before they could speak with her, before they could silence her. Those without the proper training were not meant to see prophecy. Prophecy was easily misinterpreted by those without an understanding of its intricacies. To divulge prophecy to the uninitiated was like casting fire into dry grass. Prophecy is not meant for the unenlightened. At the thought of the prophet being loose, Anne's stomach tightened into a knot. Even so, she had sometimes secretly taken Nathan out herself to go on important journeys with her, mostly journeys having to do with guiding some aspect of Richard's life, or, more accurately, trying to ensure that Richard would be born and have a life. Besides being trouble on 2 feet, Nathan was also a remarkable prophet, who did have a sincere interest in seeing their side triumph. After all, he saw in prophecy the alternative, and when Nathan saw prophecy, he saw it in all its terrible truth. Nathan always wore a ratahan, a collar, that enabled her or any sister to control him, so taking him on those journeys wasn't actually putting the world at risk of the man. He had to do as she said, go where she said. Whenever she had taken him out on a mission with her, he was not really free, since he wore a ratahan, and she could thus control him. Now he was without a ratahan. he was truly free. Anne didn't want any supper. She resolved to turn it away when they passed the pole in to her. Let Nathan fret that she might refuse food altogether and die while under his fickle control. Anne folded her arms. Let him have that on his conscience. That would bring the man down to see her. Anne heard the footsteps come to a halt outside the far door. Muffled voices drifted into her. Had she ready access to her Han, she would have been able to concentrate her hearing toward those voices and easily hear their words. She sighed. Even that ability was useless to her here in this place, under the power invoked by the spell form of the layout of the palace. It would hardly make sense to create such elaborate plans to curtail another's magic and allow them to hear secrets whispered inside the walls. The outer door squealed in protest as it was pulled open. This was new. No one had opened the outer door since the day they shut her in the place. Anne rushed to the door to her small room, to the faint square of light that was the opening in the iron door. She grabbed hold of the bars and pulled her face up close, trying to see who was out there, what they were doing. Light blinded her. She staggered back a few steps, rubbing her eyes. She was so used to the dark that the harsh lantern light felt as if it had burned her vision with blazing light. Anne backed away from the door when she heard a key clattering in the lock. The bolt threw back with a reverberating clang. The door grated open. Cool air, fresher than the stale air she was used to breathing, poured in. Yellow light flooded around the room as the lantern was thrust into the room at the end of an arm encased in red leather. Mord Sith. Chapter 30. Anne squinted in the harsh glare as the Mord Sith stepped over the sill and ducked in through the doorway into the room. Unaccustomed to the lantern light, Anne at first could only discern the red leather outfit and the blonde braid. She didn't like to contemplate why one of the Lord Rawl's elite corps of torturers would be coming down to the dungeon to see her. She knew Richard. She could not imagine that he would allow such a practice to continue. But Richard wasn't here. Nathan seemed to be in charge. Squinting, Anne at last realized that it was the woman she had seen before, Nida. Nida, appraising Anne with a cool gaze, said nothing as she stepped to the side. Another person was following her in. A long leg, wearing brown trousers, stepped over the sill, followed by a bent torso folding through the opening. Rising up to full height, Anne saw with sudden surprise who it was. Anne! Nathan held his arms wide open, as if expecting a hug. How are you? Nida gave me your message. They are treating you well, I trust. Anne stood her ground and scowled at the grinning face. I'm still alive, no thanks to you, Nathan. She, of course, remembered how tall Nathan was, how broad were his shoulders. Now, standing before her, the top of his full head of long gray hair nearly touching the stone chisel marks in the ceiling, he looked even taller than she remembered. His shoulders, filling up so much of the small room, looked even broader. He wore high boots over his trousers and a ruffled white shirt beneath an open vest. An elegant green velvet cape was attached at his right shoulder. At his left hip, a sword in an elegant scabbard glimmered in the lamplight. His face, his handsome face, so expressive, so unlike any other, made Anne's heart feel buoyant. Nathan grinned as no one but a Rawl could grin, a grin like joy and hunger and power all balled together. He looked like he needed to sweep a damsel into his powerful arms and kiss her without her permission. He waved a hand casually around at her accommodations. But you are safe here, my dear. No one can harm you while under our care. No one can bother you. You have fine food, even wine now and again. What more could you want? Fists at her side, Anne stormed forward at a pace that brought the Mord Sith sigil up into her fist, even though she stayed where she was. Nathan held his ground, held his smile as he watched her come. What more could I want? Anne screamed. What more could I want? I want to be let out. That's what more I could want. Nathan's small, knowing smile cut her to the core. "Indeed," he said. A single word of quiet indictment. Standing in the stony silence of the dungeon, she could only stare up at him, unable to bring forth an argument that he would not throw back at her. Anne turned to glare on the moored Sith. "What message did you give him?" "Nida said that you wanted to see me," Nathan answered in her place. He spread his arms. "Here I am, as requested. What is it you wanted to see me about, my dear?"
"Don't patronize me, Nathan. You know very well what I wanted to see you about. You know why I'm here, in Dahara, why I've come to the people's palace."
Nathan clasped his hands behind his back. His smile had finally lost its usefulness. "Nida," he said, turning to the woman, "would you leave us alone for now? There's a good girl." Nida appraised Anne with a brief glance. No more was needed. Anne was no threat to Nathan. He was a wizard. No doubt he had told her that he was the greatest wizard of all time, and was within the ancestral home of the House of Rohl. He had no need to fear this one old sorceress, not anymore, anyway. Nida gave Nathan a, "if you need me, I'll be right outside" kind of look, before contorting her perfect limbs through the doorway with fluid grace, the way a cat went effortlessly through a hedge. Nathan stood in the center of the cell, hands still clasped behind his upright back, waiting for Anne to say something. Anne went to her pack, sitting on the far end of the stone bench that had been her bed, her table, her chair. She flipped back the flap and reached inside, feeling around. Her fingers found the cold metal of the object she sought. Anne drew it out and stood over it, her shadow hiding it. Finally, she turned.
"Nathan, I have something for you."
She lifted out a Radahan she had intended to put around his neck. Right then, she didn't quite know how she had thought she could accomplish such a feat. She would have, though, had she put her mind to it. She was Annalena Alduran, prelate of the Sisters of the Light. Or at least, she once had been. She had given that job to Verna before feigning her and Nathan's death.
"You want me to put that collar around my neck?" Nathan asked in a calm voice.
"That's what you expect?"
Anne shook her head. "No, Nathan. I want to give this to you. I've been doing a lot of thinking while I've been down here, thinking about how I'd probably never leave my place of confinement."
"What a coincidence," Nathan said. "I used to spend a great deal of time thinking that very same thought."
"Yes," Anne said, nodding. "I expect you did."
She handed him the Radahan.
"Here, take this. I never want to see one of these again. While I did what I thought best, I hated every minute of it, Nathan. I hated to do it to you especially. I've come to think that my life has been a misguided mess. I'm sorry I ever put you behind those shields and kept you a prisoner. If I could live my life over again, I'd not do it the same way. I expect no leniency. I showed you none."
"No," Nathan said, "you didn't." His azure eyes seemed to be looking right into her. He had a way of doing that. Richard had inherited that same penetrating, raw gaze.
"So, you are sorry you kept me a prisoner all my life? Do you know why it was wrong, Anne? Are you even aware of the irony?"
Almost against her better judgment, she heard herself ask,
"What irony?"
"Well," he said as he shrugged,
"what is it we're fighting for?"
"Nathan, you know very well what we're fighting for."
"Yes, I do, but do you?
Tell me then, what is it we're struggling to protect, to preserve, to ensure remains alive?"
"The Creator's gift of magic, of course. We fight to see that it continues to exist in the world. We struggle for those who are born with it to live, for them to learn to use their ability to its full extent. We fight for each to have and to celebrate their unique ability."
"I think that's kind of ironic, don't you? The very thing you think is worth fighting for is what you feared. The Imperial Order proclaims that it's not in the best interest of mankind for a gifted individual to possess magic, so that unique ability must be stripped away from them. They claim that,
Since all do not have this ability in identical and equal measure, it's dangerous for some to have it, that man must cast aside the belief that a man's life is his own to live, that those who were born with magic must therefore be expunged from the world in order to make the world a better place for those who don't have such ability. And yet, you worked under that very premise, acted on those same wicked beliefs. You locked me away because of my ability. You saw what I am able to do that others cannot do, as an evil birthright that could not be allowed to be among mankind. And yet, you work to preserve that very thing which you fear in me, my unique ability, in others. You work to allow everyone born with magic to have the inalienable right to their own life, to be the best of what they can be with their own ability, and yet you locked me away to deny me that very same right. Just because I want the Creator's wolves to run free to hunt as they were intended doesn't mean that I want to be their dinner. Nathan leaned toward her. I am not a wolf. I am a human being. You tried, convicted, and sentenced me to life in your prison for being who I was born, for what you feared I might do, simply because I had the ability. You then soothed your own inner conflict by making that prison plush in an attempt to convince yourself that you were kind, all the while professing to believe that we must fight to allow future people to be who they are. You qualified your prison as right because it was lavish in order to mask from yourself the nature of what you were advocating. Look around, Anne. He swept his arm out at the stone. This is what you were advocating for those you decided did not have the right to their own life. You decided the same as the order based on an ability you did not like. You decided that some, because of their greater potential, must be sacrificed to the good of those less than they. No matter how you decorated your dungeon, this is what it looks like from the inside. Anne gathered her thoughts, as well as her voice, before she spoke. I thought I had come to understand something like that while I sat all alone down here, but I realize now that I hadn't really. All those years I felt bad for locking you away, but I never really examined my rationale for doing so. You're right, Nathan. I believed you held the potential for great harm. I should have helped you to understand what was right, so you could act rationally, rather than expect the worst from you and lock you away. I'm sorry, Nathan. He put his hands on his hips. Do you really mean it, Anne? She nodded, unable to look up at him, as her eyes filled with tears. She always expected honesty from everyone else, but she had not been honest with herself. Yes, Nathan, I really do. Confession over, she went to her bench and slumped down. Thank you for coming, Nathan. I'll not trouble you to come down here again. I will take my just punishment without complaint. If you don't mind, I think I'd like to be alone right now to pray and consider the weight on my heart.
You can do that later. Now get up off your bottom, on your feet, and pick up your things. We have matters to attend to, and we have to get going.
Anne looked up with a frown. What?
We have important things to do. Come on, woman. You're wasting time. We need to get going. We're on the same side of this struggle, Anne. We need to act like it and work together toward preserving our causes.
He leaned down toward her, unless you've decided to retire to sit around the rest of your life. If not, then let's be on our way. We have trouble.
Anne hopped down from the stone bench.
Trouble? What sort of trouble?
Prophecy trouble.
Prophecy? There is trouble with the prophecy? What trouble? What prophecy?
Fists on his hips, Nathan fixed her with a scowl. I can't tell you about such things. Prophecy is not meant for the unenlightened.
Anne pursed her lips, about to launch into scolding him up one side and down the other, when she caught the smile working at the edges of his mouth. It caught her up in a smile of her own.
What's happened?
She asked in the tone of voice friends used when they had decided that past wrongs were recognized and matters now set on a correct path.
Anne, you'll not believe it when I tell you, Nathan complained. It's that boy again.
Richard?
What other boy do you know who can get in the kind of trouble only Richard can get into?
Well, I no longer think of Richard as a boy.
Nathan sighed. I suppose not. but it's hard when you're my age to think of one so young as a man.
He's a man,
Anne assured him. Yes, I guess he is, Nathan grinned. And he's a Rawl.
What sort of trouble has Richard gotten himself into this time?
Nathan's good humor evaporated. He's walked off the edge of prophecy. Anne screwed up her face.
What are you talking about? What's he done?
I'm telling you, Anne, that boy has walked right off the edge of prophecy itself, walked right off into a place in prophecy where prophecy itself doesn't exist.
Anne recognized that Nathan was sincerely troubled, but he was making no sense. In part, that was why some people were afraid of him. He often gave people the impression he was talking gibberish when he was talking about things that no one but he could even understand. Sometimes no one but a prophet could truly understand completely what he grasped. With his eyes, the eyes of a prophet, he could see things that no one else could.
She had spent a lifetime working with prophecy, though, and so she could understand, perhaps better than most, at least some of his mind, some of what he could grasp.
How can you know of such a prophecy, Nathan, if it doesn't exist? I don't understand. Explain it to me.
There are libraries here at the People's Palace that contain some valuable books of prophecy that I've never had a chance to see before. While I had a reason to suspect that such prophecies might exist, I was never certain they actually did or what they might say. I've been studying them since I've been here, and I've come across links to other known prophecy we had down in the vaults at the Palace of the Prophets. These prophecies here fill in some important gaps in those we already know about. Most importantly, I found an altogether new branch of prophecy I've never seen before that explains why and how I've been blind to some of what's been going on. From studying the forks and inversions off of this branch, I've discovered that Richard has taken a series of links that follow down a particular pathway of prophecy that leads to oblivion, to something that, as far as I can tell, doesn't even exist. One hand on a hip, the other tracing invisible lines in the air, Nathan paced the small room as he talked. This new link alludes to things I've never seen before, branches that I've always known must be there, but were missing. These branches are exceedingly dangerous prophecies that have been kept here in secret. I can see why. Even I, had I seen them years ago, might have misinterpreted them. These new branches refer to voids of some sort. Since they are voids, their nature can't be known. Such a contradiction can't exist. Richard has gone into this area of void where prophecy can't see him, can't help him, and worse, can't help us. But more than not seeing him with prophecy, it's as if where he is and what he is doing do not exist. Richard is dealing in something that is capable of ending everything we know. Anne knew that Nathan would not exaggerate about something of this nature. While she was in the dark about precisely what he was talking about, the essence of it gave her the cold sweats.
What can we do about it?
Nathan threw up his arms. We have to go in there and get him. We have to bring him back into the world that exists.
You mean the world that prophecy says exists?
Nathan's scowl was back. That's what I said, isn't it? We have to somehow get him back on the thread of prophecy where he shows up. Anne cleared her throat.
Or?
Nathan snatched up the lamp, then her pack. Or he will cease to be part of viable lines of prophecy, never to be involved with matters of this world again.
You mean, if we don't get him back from wherever he is, he will die?
Nathan gave her a curious look.
Have I been talking to the walls? Of course he will die. If that boy isn't in prophecy, if he breaks all the links to prophecy where he plays a role, then he voids all those lines of prophecy where he exists. If he does that, then they become false prophecy, and those branches with word of him will never come to pass. None of the other links contain any reference to him, because in the origin of those links, he dies first.
And what happens on those links that don't contain him? Nathan took up her hand as he pulled her toward the door. On those links, a shadow falls over everyone, everyone who lives anyway. It will be a very long and very dark age.
Wait, Anne said, pulling him to a halt. She returned to the stone bench and placed the Radahan in the center.
"I don't have the power to destroy this. I think maybe it should be locked away."
Nathan nodded his approval. "We will lock the doors and instruct the guards that it is to remain in here behind the shields for all time." Anne held a warning finger up before him.
"Don't get the idea that just because you're not wearing a collar, I will tolerate misbehavior."
Nathan's grin returned. He didn't come right out and agree. Before he went through the door, he turned back to her. "By the way, have you been talking to Verna through your journey book?"
"Yes, a little." "She's with the army and pretty busy right now. They're defending the passes into Dahara. Jigang has begun his siege."
"Well, from what I've been able to gather from military commanders here at the palace, the passes are formidable and will hold for a while at least." He leaned toward her. "You have to send a message to her, though. Tell her that when an empty wagon rolls into their line, to let it through." Anne made a face.
"What does that mean?"
"Prophecy is not meant for the unenlightened. Just tell her."
"All right,"
Anne said with breathless difficulty as Nathan pulled her through the tight doorway.
"But I'd best not tell her that you're the one who said it, or she will likely ignore the advice. She thinks you're daft, you know."
"She just never got the chance to come to know me very well, that's all." He glanced back. "What with me being unjustly locked away and all." Anne wanted to say that perhaps Verna knew Nathan all too well, but decided better of it right then. As Nathan started to turn toward the outer door, Anne snatched his sleeve.
"Nathan, what else about this prophecy you found aren't you telling me? This prophecy where Richard disappears into oblivion?"
She knew Nathan well enough to know by his agitation that he hadn't told her everything, that he thought he was being gallant by sparing her worry. With a sober expression, he gazed into her eyes for a long time before he finally spoke. "There is a slide on that fork of prophecy." Anne frowned as she turned, her eyes up in thought.
A slide.
She muttered to herself, trying to recall the name. It sounded familiar.
A slide.
She snapped her fingers.
A slide.
Her eyes went wide.
Dear Creator.
I don't think the Creator had anything to do with this. Anne impatiently waved in protest.
That can't be. There has to be something wrong with this new prophecy you found. It has to be defective. Slides were created in the Great War. There couldn't be a slide on this link of prophecy, don't you see? The prophecy must be out of phase and long ago expired.
Anne chewed her lower lip as her mind raced. It isn't out of phase. Don't you think that was my first thought, too? You think me an amateur at this? I worked through the chronology 100 times. I ran every chart and calculation I ever learned, even some I invented for the task. They all came out with the same root. Every link came out in order. The prophecy is in phase. Chronology and all its aspects are aligned.
Then it's a false link, Anne insisted. Slides were conjured creatures. They were sterile. They couldn't reproduce.
I'm telling you, Nathan growled, there is a slide on this fork with Richard, and it's a viable prophetic link.
They couldn't have survived to be here.
Anne was sure of what she was saying. Nathan knew more about prophecy than she. There was no doubt of that. But this was one area where she knew exactly what she was talking about. This was her area of expertise.
Slides weren't able to beget children.
He was giving her one of those looks she didn't like. I'm telling you, a slide walks the world again. Anne tisked.
Nathan, soul stealers can't reproduce.
The prophecy says he wasn't born, but born again, a slide. Anne's flesh began to tingle. She stared at him a time before finding her voice.
For 3,000 years there have been no wizards born with both sides of the gift but Richard. There is no way anyone...
Anne paused. He was watching her. Watching her finally realize what had to be.
Dear Creator,
she whispered. I told you the Creator had nothing to do with this. The Sisters of the Dark mothered him. Shaken to her core, Anne could think of nothing to say. There was no worse news she could have heard. There was no defense against a slide. Every soul was naked to a slide's attack. Outside the second door, Nida waited in the hall, her face as grim as ever, but not as grim as Anne's. The hall was dark, but for the dim light coming from the still flames of a few candles. No breath of wind ever made it this deep into the palace. The only color among the dark rocks soaking up that small bit of light was the blood red of Nida's red leather. Being pulled along by the hand, feeling a jumble of emotions, Anne leaned toward the woman and vented a pent-up, fiery scowl.
"You told him what I said to tell him, didn't you?"
"Of course," Nida answered as she fell into step in behind the two of them. Turning halfway around, Anne shook a finger at the moored Sith.
"I'll make you sorry you told him,"
Nida smiled.
"Oh, I don't think so."
Anne rolled her eyes and turned back to Nathan.
"By the way, what are you doing wearing a sword? You of all people a wizard. Why are you wearing a sword?"
Nathan looked hurt.
"Why, Nida thinks I look dashing with a sword."
Anne fixed her eyes on the dark passageway ahead.
"I just bet she does."
Chapter 31. Standing at the edge of a narrow rim of rock, Richard looked down on the ragged gray wisps of clouds below. Out in the open, the cool, damp air that drifted over him carried the aromas of balsam trees, moss, wet leaves, and saturated soil. He inhaled deeply the fragrant reminders of home. The rock, mostly granite, cracked and weather-worn, into pillowed blocks, looked much the same as that in his heartland woods. The mountains, however, were far larger. The slope rising up behind him was dizzying. To the west before him, far below, lay a vast stretch of fractured ground and ever-rising rugged hills carpeted in forests. To his left and right, because he knew what he was looking for, he could just make out the strip of ground, devoid of trees, where the boundary had been. Farther off to the west rose up the lesser mountains, mostly barren, that bordered the wasteland. That wasteland, and the place called the Pillars of Creation, was no longer visible. Richard was happy to have left it far behind. The sky was empty of black-tipped races, for the moment anyway. The huge birds most likely knew that Richard, Kalin, Kara, Jensen, Tom, and Owen were heading west. Richard had shot the last five as they had begun gathering in their circling behavior, surprising them by being high up on the side of the mountain above the others in his group, closer to where the races flew. After killing the races, Richard had led the rest of his small company into denser woods. He didn't think that the races they'd been seeing up until then had spotted them since. Now that they were traveling through forests of towering trees, Richard thought that, if he was careful, they might be able to lose their watchers. If this man, Nicholas, had seen them through the eyes of those five races, then he knew they had been headed west. But now that they were hidden, he couldn't assume that they would continue west. If Richard could disappear from where the birds would look for him and fail to appear where they would expect him, then Nicholas might have second thoughts. He might realize they could have changed direction and gone north or south. Nicholas might then begin to realize that they had used that period of confusion to run away somewhere else to flee him. It was possible that Richard could keep them hidden under the cover of the trees and in so doing keep Nicholas from discovering them. Richard didn't want the man to know where they'd gone or to have any idea where they were at any given time. It was hardly a certainty that he could deceive Nicholas in this way, but Richard intended to try. Shielding his eyes with the flat of his hand, Richard scanned the rise of dense forest before them in order to get the lay of the land fixed in his mind before he headed back in under the thick vegetation where the others waited. The trailers of clouds below were but the tattered cast-offs of the churning blanket of gloom above them. The mountainside ascended sharply into that wet overcast. As Richard evaluated the rock, the slope, and the trees, he finally found what he sought. He studied the ascent of the mountain one last time before scanning the sky again to make sure it was clear. Seeing no races, or any other birds for that matter, he headed in to where the others waited. He knew that just because he didn't see any birds didn't mean that they weren't there watching him. There could be a few dozen races, sitting in trees where he would likely never spot them. But for the moment, he was still where they would expect him, so he wasn't greatly concerned. He was about to do what they would not expect. Richard climbed back up the slick bank of moss, leaves, and wet roots. If he fell, he would have only the one chance to grab the small ledge where he'd been standing before he would tumble out into the clear air and a drop of several thousand feet. The thought of that drop made him hold tighter to the roots to help him climb, and made him test carefully every score in the rock where he placed his boot before committing his weight to it. At the top of the bank, he ducked under overhanging branches of scrawny mountain maple that grew in the understory of hardwoods, leaning out beside the towering pines in an effort to capture the light. Leaves of the ash and birch, rising above the mountain maple, collected the drizzle, until their leaves had as much as they could hold and released it to patter down in fat drops that slapped the lower leaves above Richard's head. When a light breeze caught those upper leaves, they released their load to rain down in sudden but brief torrents. Stooping under low-spreading branches of fir trees, Richard followed his track back through thickets of huckleberry into the more open ground of the hushed woods beneath the thick canopy of ancient evergreens. Pine needles had been woven by the wind into sprawling mats that cushioned his steps. Spiraling webs hung by spiders to catch the small bugs that zigzagged all about had instead netted the mist and were now dotted with shimmering drops of water, like jeweled necklaces on display. Back in the sheltering cover of rock and the thick growth of young spruce, Kaylin stood when she saw Richard coming. When she stood, everyone else then saw him and came to their feet as well. Richard ducked in under the wispy green branches. "Did you see any races, Lord Rawl?" Owen asked, clearly nervous about the predators. "No," Richard told him as he picked up his pack and slung it over a shoulder. He slipped his other arm beneath the second strap as he pulled the pack up onto his back. "That doesn't mean they didn't see me, though." Richard hooked his bow over the back of his left shoulder along with a water skin. "Well," Owen said, wringing his hands, "we can still hope they won't know where we are." Richard paused to look at the man. Hope is not a strategy. As the rest of them all started collecting their things from the brief break, hooking gear on belts and shouldering packs, Richard drew Kara by the arm out of the cover of small trees and pulled her close. "See that rise through there?" he asked, as he held her near him so she could see where he was pointing, with the strip of open ground that passes in front of the young oak with a broken dead limb hanging down. Kara nodded. "Just after where the ground rises and goes over that trickle of water running down the face of the rock staining it green, that's the spot. I want you to follow up over that area, then cut to the right, taking that cleft up, the one there beyond the split in the rock, there, and see if you can scout a trail up to the next shelf above these trees here." Kara nodded. "Where will you be?" "I'm going to take the rest of us up to the first break in the slope. We'll be there. Come back and tell us if you find a way over the projection." Kara hoisted up her pack onto her back and then picked up the stout staff Richard had cut for her.
"I didn't know that Mord Sith could cut trails," Tom said.
"Mord Sith can't," Kara said. "I, Kara, can. Lord Rawl taught me." As she vanished into the trees, Richard watched her walk. She moved gracefully, disturbing little as she made her way into the trackless woods. She moved with an economy of effort that would conserve her energy. It had not always been so. She had learned well the lessons he had given her. Richard was pleased to see that the lessons had stuck and his efforts had not been wasted. Owen came forward looking agitated.
"But Lord Rawl, we can't go that way."
He waggled a hand back over his shoulder.
"The trail goes that way. That is the only way up and through the pass."
There lies the way down, and with it the way back up, now that the boundary is gone. It's not easy, but it's the only way.
It's the only way you know of. By how well that trail looks to be traveled, I think it's the only way Nicholas knows of as well. It appears to be the way the order troops move in and out of Bandakar. If we go that way, the races will be watching. If, on the other hand, we don't show up, then he won't know where we went. I want to keep it that way from now on. I'm tired of playing mouse to his owl. Richard let Kalin lead them up through the woods, following the natural route of the land, when the way ahead was reasonably evident. When she was in doubt, she would glance back at him for direction. Richard would look where she was to go or not in the direction he wanted her to take, or, in a few cases, he needed to give her instruction. By the lay of the land, Richard was pretty sure that there was an ancient trail up through the mountain pass. That pass, that from afar looked like a notch in the wall of mountains, was in reality no mere notch, but a broad area twisting as it rose back up between the mountains. Richard didn't think that the path that the Bandakar people used to banish people through the boundary was the only way through that pass. With the boundary in place, it may well have been, but the boundary was no longer there. From what he'd seen so far, Richard suspected that there once had been a route that in ancient times had been the main way in and out. Here and there he was able to discern depressions that he believed were remnants of that ancient, abandoned route. While it was always possible that the old passage had been abandoned for good reason, such as a landslide that made it impassable, he wanted to know if that once-traveled way was still usable. It would, at the least, since it was in a different part of the mountains than the known path, take them away from where the races were likely to be looking for them. Jensen walked up close beside Richard, when the way through towering pines was open enough. She tugged Betty along by her rope, keeping her from stopping to sample plants along the way.
"Sooner or later the races will find us, don't you think?" Jensen asked. "I mean, if we don't show up where they expect to find us, then don't you think they will search until they do find us? You were the one who said that from the sky they could cover great distances and search us out."
"Maybe," Richard said. "But it will be hard to spot us in the woods if we use our heads and stay hidden. In forests, they can't search nearly as much area as they could in the same amount of time out in the wasteland. In open ground, they could spot us miles away. Here, they will have a hard time of it unless they're really close and we are careless. By the time we don't show up where the known trail makes it up into Bandakar, they will have a vast area they suddenly will need to search. And they won't have any idea which direction to look. That compounds the problem for them in finding us. I don't think that the viewing Nicholas gets through their eyes can be very good, or he wouldn't need to gather the races now and again to circle. If we can stay out of sight long enough, then we'll be among the people up in Bandakar, and then Nicholas, through the eyes of the races, will have a hard, if not impossible, time picking us out from others." Jensen thought it over as they entered a stand of birch. Betty went the wrong way around a tree, and Jensen had to stop to untangle her rope. They all hunched their shoulders against the wet when a breeze brought down a soaking shower.
"Richard?"
Jensen asked in a voice barely above a whisper as she caught back up with him.
"What are you going to do when we get there?"
"I'm going to get the antidote so I don't die."
"I know that."
Jensen pulled a sodden ringlet of red hair back from her face.
"What I mean is, what are you going to do about Owen's people?"
Each breath he drew brought a slight stitch of pain deep in his lungs. "I'm not sure yet, just what I can do." Jensen walked in silence for a moment.
"But you will try to help them, won't you?"
Richard glanced over at his sister. "Jensen, they're threatening to kill me. They've proven that it isn't an empty threat." She shrugged uncomfortably.
"I know, but they're desperate."
She glanced ahead to make sure that Owen wouldn't hear.
"They didn't know what else to do to save themselves. They aren't like you. They never fought anyone before."
Richard took a deep breath, the pain pulling tight across his chest when he did so. "You'd never fought anyone before either, when you thought I was trying to kill you as our father had, and you believed that I was responsible for your mother's death. What did you do? I don't mean were you correct about me.
But what did you do in response to what you believed was happening?
I resolved that if I wanted to live, I would have to kill you before you killed me.
Exactly. You didn't poison someone and tell them to do it, or they would die. You decided that your life was worth living and that no one else had the right to take it from you. When you were willing to meekly sacrifice your ultimate value, your life, the only one you will ever have, to any thug who on a whim decides to take it from you, then you can't be helped. You may be able to be rescued for one day, but the next day another will come and you will again willingly prostrate yourself before him. You have placed the value of the life of your killer above your own. When you grant to anyone who demands it the right of life or death over you, you have already become a willing slave in search of any butcher who will have you. She walked in silence for a time, thinking about what he'd said. Richard noticed that she moved through the woods as he had taught Kara to move. She was nearly as at home in the woods as he was.
"Richard," Jensen swallowed, "I don't want those people to be hurt anymore. They've already suffered enough."
"Tell that to Kalen if I die from their poison." When they reached the meeting place, Kara wasn't there yet. They all were ready for a brief rest. The spot, a break in the slope back against granite that rose up steeply to the next projection in the mountain, was protected high overhead by huge pines and closer down by brush. After so long out in the heat of the desert, none of them were yet accustomed to the wet chill. While they spread out to find rocks for seats so they wouldn't have to sit in the wet leaf litter, Betty happily sampled the tasty weeds. Owen sat to the far side away from Betty. Kalen sat close to Richard on a small lump of rock.
"How are you doing? You look like you have a headache."
"Nothing to be done about it for now," he said. Kalen leaned closer. The warmth of her felt good against his side.
"Richard," she whispered, "remember Nikki's letter?"
"What about it?"
"Well, we assumed that this boundary into Bandicar being down was the reason for the first warning beacon. Maybe we're wrong."
"What makes you think so?"
"No second beacon."
She pointed with her chin off to the northwest.
"We saw the first way back down there. We're a lot closer to the place where the boundary was, and we haven't spotted a second beacon."
"Just as well," he said. "That was where the races were waiting for us." He remembered very well when they found the little statue. The races were perched in trees all around. Richard hadn't known what they were at the time, other than they were large birds he'd never seen before. The instant Kara picked up the statue, the black-tipped races had all suddenly taken to wing. There had been hundreds.
"Yes," Kalen said, "but without the second beacon, maybe this isn't the problem that we thought caused the first.
You're assuming that the second beacon will be for me, that I'm the one it will be meant for, and so we would have seen it. Nikki said that the second beacon is for the one who has the power to fix the breach in the seal. Maybe that's not me." Looking at first startled by the idea, Kalen thought it over.
"I'm not sure if I'd be pleased about that or not."
She leaned tighter against him and hooked an arm around his thigh.
"But no matter who is meant to be the one who can seal the breach again, the one who's supposed to restore the boundary, I don't think they will be able to do so."
Richard ran his fingers back through his wet hair. "Well, if I'm the one this dead wizard once believed could restore the boundary, he's wrong. I don't know how to do such a thing."
"But don't you see, Richard? Even if you did know how, I don't think you could."
Richard looked at her out of the corner of his eye. "Jumping to conclusions and letting your imagination get carried away again?"
"Richard, face it. The boundary failed because of what I did. That's why the warning beacon was for me, because I caused the seal to fail. You aren't going to try to deny that, are you?"
"No. But we have a lot to learn before we know what's really going on."
"I freed the chimes," she said. "It's not going to do us any good to try to hide from that fact."
Kalen had used ancient magic to save his life. She had freed the chimes in order to heal him. She'd had no time to spare. He would have died within moments if she had not acted. Moreover, she'd had no idea that the chimes would unleash destruction upon the world.
She hadn't known they had been created 3,000 years before from underworld powers as a weapon designed to consume magic. She had been told only that she must use them to save Richard's life. Richard knew what it felt like to be convinced of the facts behind events and to have no one believe him. He knew she was now feeling that same frustration. "You're right that we can't hide from it if it's a fact, but right now we don't know that it is. For one thing, the chimes have been banished back to the underworld. And what about what Zed told us, about how once the destructive cascade of magic begins, which it did, then there is no telling if it can be stopped even if the chimes are banished? There is no experience in such an event upon which to base predictions." Richard didn't have an answer for her, and was at a disadvantage because he didn't have her education in magic. He was saved from having to speculate when Kara came in through a tight patch of young balsam trees. She pulled her pack off her shoulders and let it slip to the ground as she sat on a rock facing Richard. "You were right. We can get through there. It looks to me like I can see a way to continue on up from the ledge."
"Good," Richard said as he stood. "Let's get going. The clouds are getting darker. I think we need to find a place to stop for the night."
"I spotted a place under the ledge, Lord Rawl. I think it might be a dry place to stay."
"Good." Richard hoisted her pack. "I'll carry this for you for a while, let you have a break."
Kara nodded her appreciation, falling into line as they moved through the tight trees and immediately had to start to climb up the steeply rising ground. There was enough exposed rock and roots to provide good steps and handholds. Where some of those steps were tall, Richard stretched down to give Kaelin a hand. Tom helped Jensen and passed Betty up a few times, even though the goat was better at scrambling up over rock than they were. Richard thought he was doing it more for Jensen's peace of mind than for Betty's. Jensen finally told Tom that Betty could climb on her own. Betty proved her right, bleating down at Tom after effortlessly clambering up a particularly trying spot.
"Then why don't you help me up then?"
Tom said to the goat. Jensen smiled along with Richard and Kaelin. Owen just watched as he skirted the other way around the rock. He was afraid of Betty. Kara finally asked for her pack back, having entertained long enough the possibility of being considered frail. Shortly after the rain started, they found the low slit of an opening under a prominent ledge, just as Kara had said they would. It wasn't a cave, but a spot where a slab from the face of the mountain above had broken off and fallen over. Boulders on the ground held the slab up enough to create a pocket beneath. It wasn't large, but Richard thought they would all fit under it for the night. The ground was dirty, scattered with collected leaf litter and forest debris of bark, moss, and a lot of bugs. Tom and Richard used branches they'd cut to quickly sweep the place out. Then they lay down a clean bed of evergreen boughs to keep them up off the water that did run in. The rain was starting to come down harder, so they all squatted down and hurried to move in under the rock. It wasn't a comfortable-looking spot, being too low for them to stand in, but it was fairly dry. Richard dared not let them have a fire, now that they had left the regular trail, lest the smoke be spotted by the races. They had a cold supper of meats, leftover bannock, and dried goods. They were all exhausted from climbing all day, and while they ate, engaged in only a bit of small talk. Betty was the only one with enough room to stand. She pushed up against Richard until she got his attention and a rub. As darkness slowly enveloped the woods, they watched the rain fall outside their cozy shelter, listening to the soft sound, all no doubt wondering what lay ahead in a strange empire that had been sealed away for 3,000 years. Troops from the Imperial Order would be there too. As Richard sat watching out into the dark rain, listening to the sounds of the occasional animal in the distance, Kaelin cuddled up beside him, laying her head on his lap. Betty went deeper into the shelter and lay down with Jensen. Kaelin, under the comfort of his hand resting tenderly on her shoulder, was asleep in moments. As weary as he was from the day's hard journey, Richard wasn't sleepy. His head hurt, and the poison deep within him made each breath catch. He wondered what would strike him down first, the power of his gift that was giving him the headaches, or Owen's poison.
He wondered, too, just how he was going to satisfy the demands of Owen and his men to free their empire so that he could have the antidote. The five of them, he, Kalin, Kara, Jensen, and Tom, hardly seemed the army needed to drive the order out of Bandekar. If he didn't, and if he couldn't get to the antidote, his life was coming to a close. This very well could be his final journey. It seemed like he had just gotten back together with Kalin after being separated from her for half his life. He wanted to be with her. He wanted the two of them to be able to be alone. If he didn't think of something, all they had in each other, all they had ahead of them, was just about over. And that was without even considering the headaches of the gift. Or the Imperial Order capturing the Wizard's Keep. Chapter 32. Richard gripped the edge of the rock at the face of the opening to help pull himself up and out from the dark hole in the abrupt rise of granite before them. Once out, he brushed the sharp little granules of rock from his hands as he turned to the others. It goes through. It isn't easy, but it goes through. He saw a dubious look on Tom's face and a look of consternation on Owen's. Betty, her floppy ears perked ahead in what Richard thought could be only a goat frown, peered down into the narrow chasm and bleated.
"But I don't think we can," Owen complained.
"What if we get stuck?" Richard asked. Owen nodded. "Well, you have an advantage over Tom and me," Richard said as he picked up his pack from nearby to the side where he'd left it. "You're not quite as big. If I made it through and back, then you can make it, Owen." Owen waved a hand up the steep ascent to his right.
"But what about that way? Couldn't we just go around?"
"I don't like going into dark, narrow places like this either," Richard said. "But if we go around that way, we have to go out on the ledges. You heard what Kara said. It's narrow and dangerous. If it were the only way, it would be another matter, but it's not. The races could spot us out there. Worse, if they wanted, they could attack us and we could easily fall or be forced over the edge. I don't like going in places like this, but I don't think I'd like to be out there on a wind-blown ledge no wider than the sole of my boot, with a fall of thousands of feet straight down if I make one slip, and then have one of those races suddenly show up and rip into me with their talons or those sharp beaks of theirs. Would you prefer that?" Owen licked his lips as he bent at the waist and looked into the narrow passageway.
"Well, I guess you're right."
"Richard," Kalin asked in a whisper as the rest of them started taking off their packs so they could more easily fit through,
"if this was a trail as you suspect, why isn't there a better way through?"
"I think that sometime only in the last few thousand years this huge section of mountain broke away and slid down, coming to rest at this angle, leaving a narrow passageway beneath it." He pointed up. "See up there? I think this entire portion down here used to be up there. I think it's now sitting right where the trail used to be."
"And there's no other way but this cave or the ledges?"
"I'm not saying that. I believe there are other old routes. But we would have to backtrack for most of a day to take the last fork I saw, and then there isn't any guarantee with that one either. If you really want, though, we can go back and try." Kalin shook her head.
"We can't afford to lose any time. We need to get to the antidote."
Richard nodded. He didn't know how he was supposed to rid an entire empire of the Imperial Order so they could get to the antidote, but he had a few ideas. He needed to get the antidote. He saw no reason he had to play by Owen's rules or the orders. Kalin gave the narrow, dark tunnel another look.
"You're sure there aren't any snakes in there?"
"I didn't see any." Tom handed Richard his sword. "I'll go last," he said. "If you make it through, I can." Richard nodded as he laid the baldric over his shoulder. He turned the scabbard at his hip in order to clear the rock and then started in. He hugged his pack to his abdomen as he crouched to make it into the small space. The slab of rock above him lay at an angle, so that he couldn't remain upright, but had to twist sideways and back as he went into the darkness. The farther in he went, the darker it became. As the others followed him into the narrow passage, it blocked much of the light, making it even darker. The rains of recent days had finally ended, but
but runnels and runoff continued to flow from the mountain. Their wading through ankle-deep water standing in the bottom of the cavern sent echoes through the narrow confines. The waves in the water played gloomy light along the wet walls, providing at least some illumination. The thought occurred to him that if he was a snake, this would make a good spot to call home. The thought also occurred to him that if Kaelin, right behind him, happened upon a snake in such cramped quarters, she would not be pleased with him in the least for taking her in. Things that were frightening outside were different when you couldn't maneuver, couldn't run. Panic always seemed to lurk in tight places. As it became darker, Richard had to feel his way along the cold stone. In places where water seeped down the rock, the walls were slimy. In some spots, there was mud. In other spots, dry rock to walk on. Most of it, though, was wet muck. Spongy leaves had collected in some of the irregular low places. By the smell, it was obvious that some animal had died and was decomposing somewhere in the sodden grotto. He heard moans and complaints from behind when the rest of them encountered the stench. Betty bleated her unhappiness. Jensen's echoing whisper told the goat to be quiet. Even the displeasure of the smell was forgotten as they worked their way under the immense curtain of rock draped over where the trail used to be. This wasn't a true cave, like underground caves Richard had encountered before. It was only a narrow crack under what was, in essence, a big rock. There were no chambers and different routes to worry about. There was only one narrow void under the rock, so lighting their way wasn't critical. He knew, too, that it wasn't all that long. It only felt that way in the dark. Richard reached the spot where the way ahead abruptly started up at a steep angle. Feeling the walls all around to find places to grab, he started the difficult climb. In places, he had to wedge his back against one wall and use his feet against the opposite wall to brace himself, while grappling for any ledge or crack in the rock he could find to help pull himself up. He had to balance his pack in his lap as he went and keep his sword from getting wedged. It was slow going. Richard finally reached the high table where the rock from above had first come down. The hollow left under the mountain of rock was basically horizontal rather than vertical as it had been. Rock rested along the edge of most of the shelf, but there was one place with ample room for them to make it through, over the edge and then in under the slab above them. Once up onto the flat, he leaned over as far as he could, extending a hand down to help Kaelin. He heard the grunts of effort from below Kaelin as the rest of the small company worked their way up the precipitous passage. From his place atop the table of rock, Richard could finally see light ahead and light above. He had scouted the route and knew that they were close to being out the other side, but first they had to make it across the shelf of rock where the slab left little room above them. It was uncomfortably confining. Richard didn't like such places. He knew, though, that there was no other way through. This was the place he worried most about. Tight as it was fortunately close to the end. "We have to crawl on our bellies from here," he told Kaelin. "Hold my ankle. Have everyone behind do the same." Kaelin peered ahead toward the light coming from the opening. The glare of that light made it difficult to see to the sides.
"Richard, it doesn't look big enough. It's just a crack."
Richard pushed his pack out onto the rock. "There's a way. We'll be out soon." Kaelin let out a deep breath.
"All right. The sooner the better."
"Listen to me," he called back into the darkness. "We're almost out.
If you make us walk through any more rotting animals, I'll clobber you,"
Jensen called up to him. Everyone laughed.
"No more of that," Richard said. "But there is a difficult spot ahead. I've been through it, so I know we can all make it. But you have to listen to me and do as I say. Crawl on your stomach, pushing your pack ahead of you. Hold the ankle of the person in front of you. That way you'll all follow in the right place. You'll see the light ahead of you. You can't go toward the light. That isn't the way out. The ceiling drops down too low and the slope of the rock starts pitching down to the left. If you slip down in there, it gets even tighter. You'll not be able to get out.
We have to go around the low place in the ceiling. We have to go around on the right side, where it's dark, but not as low. Does everyone understand?
Agreement echoed up from the darkness.
Richard?
Jensen called in a small voice.
I don't like being in here. I want out.
Her voice carried a threat of panic. I don't either, he told her, but I've been through and out the other side. I made it through and back. You'll be fine. Just follow me and you won't have a problem. Her voice drifted up to him from the darkness.
I want to go back.
Richard couldn't let her go back. The ledges, where they were exposed to the races, were too dangerous.
Here, Kaelin told her. You come ahead of me. Take hold of Richard's ankle and you'll be out before the rest of us.
I'll see that Betty watches you go through and follows, Tom offered. That seemed to break the impasse. Jensen moved up to the ledge and handed her pack up. Richard, lying on his stomach in the low slit of the shelf, took her hand to help her up. When she saw in the light how low and tight it was that Richard had to lie on his stomach, she started to tremble. When Richard helped pull her up and her face came up close to him, he could see her tears in the dim light. Her wide blue eyes took in the way ahead, how low it was.
Please, Richard, I'm afraid. I don't want to go in under there.
He nodded. I know, but it's not far. I won't let you stay in here. I'll see that you get out. He cupped a hand to the side of her face. I promise.
How do I know you'll keep your promise?
Richard smiled. Wizards always keep their promises.
You said you don't know much about being a wizard.
But I know how to keep promises. She at last agreed and let him help her the rest of the way up. When he pulled her all the way up onto the shelf of the mountainside and she actually felt how the roof of rock didn't allow her any room to get up and that she had to lie flat just to fit, and worse, that the roof of rock was only scant inches above her back, she started to shiver with terror. I know how you feel, he told her. I do, Jensen. I hate this too. But we have no choice. It's not dangerous if you just follow me through the place where there's room. Just follow me and we'll be out before you know it.
What if it comes down and crushes us? Or what if it comes down just enough to pin us so we can't move or breathe?
It won't, he insisted. It's been here for ages. It isn't going to come down. It's not. She nodded, but he didn't know if she really heard him. She began to whimper as he turned himself around so he could lead her out. Take my ankle, he called back to her. Here, push your pack up to me and I'll take care of it for you. Then you'll only have to worry about holding on to my ankle and following behind.
What if it gets too tight and I can't breathe? Richard, what if I can't breathe?
Richard kept his voice calm and confident. I'm bigger than you, so if I fit, you will. She only nodded as she shivered. He extended his hand back and had to tell her again to pass her pack forward before she did as he instructed. Once he had her pack, he tied the straps to his and pushed them both on ahead. She seized his ankle as if it were the only thing keeping her from falling into the arms of the keeper of the underworld. He didn't complain, though, about how hard she held him. He knew her fear. Richard pushed the packs out ahead and started inching his way forward. He tried not to think about the rough ceiling of rock, only a hand width above his back.